Hello, and welcome to the Westminster Institute. I'm Robert Riley, its director. Today, we're very pleased to welcome a new guest to the Westminster Institute for a discussion, and that is Doug Bandow, who is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. I will just share a slight anecdote concerning our relationship, because in past years, we met through debates on foreign policy, where we were taken to summer schools of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and we would debate in front of the students on key foreign policy questions. And that was the beginning of a beautiful relationship, so I'm delighted to have him here. Let me tell you some more about Doug Bandow. At Cato, he specializes in foreign policy and civil liberties. He worked as a special assistant to President Ronald Reagan and as editor of the political magazine Inquiry. Doug writes a great deal and very well for such leading publications as Fortune, National Interest, Wall Street Journal, Washington Times, and others. He's been a regular commentator on ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC. Aside from the many articles that Doug has written, he's also written a number of books, and I'll just include some of them. Foreign Follies, America's New Global Empire. The Korean Conundrum, America's Troubled Relations with North and South Korea. Tripwire, Korea and U.S. Foreign Policy in a Changed World. And Perpetuating Poverty, the World Bank, the IMF, and the Developing World. Today, Doug is going to answer for us the intriguing question, should the U.S. or Europe make NATO great again? Doug, welcome to the program.
Well, Bob, thanks for having me on. It's a great pleasure to be here with you personally, as well as the Westminster Institute, whose work I admire. And these are important times, and this, I think, is a very good topic for us to go over. I mean, if you look at the challenges facing the United States, one is we have a very significant international challenge, where the U.S. is involved very deeply in Europe, frankly running essentially a proxy war plus against Russia, a nuclear-armed power. I mean, this is a very dangerous situation. We're deeply involved in the Middle East. Every president says they want to get out, and lo and behold, we seem to end up even more involved. And we have an extraordinary challenge in Asia, not only North Korea, but obviously China. China, which, depending on how things go, could become a peer competitor to the United States, even if not. It's a very different challenge from the Soviet Union. And the problem is we're in a world in which the expectation appears to be that the U.S. has to dominate all of these. And it's almost as if we don't have allies. We talk about allies, but it seems like it's America's job to do most everything. Now, that comes at a time where we have a fiscal crisis that's coming. I mean, we have trillion-dollar deficits without the kind of financial crisis of 2008, without crisis. This is now the daily routine of Washington. We're at about 100% of GDP in terms of federal debt. We're heading towards the record that was set in 1946, 106%. That was coming out of the worst war in world history. And today we're almost at that level in kind of relative peacetime. And given growth rates of spending, this Congressional Budget Office figures are going to be at 185% by 2050. Now, Greece, you know, went into its crisis at something like 140%. I mean, it's hard to imagine how we could ever make it to 185%. And the problem is on the spending is there's really only, you know, people talk about domestic discretionary spending, but there are five big piles to go after, and no one wants to touch them. One is interest, which you can't go after unless you repudiate the debt. And interest rates, of course, are rising. And that means ever more money is going to go to interest. I mean, the CBO tells us by the end of the decade, we could have $800 billion in interest payments. Now, that's more than, you know, that's almost as much as we spend on the military today. That comes off the top. Then there's Social Security and Medicare. Those are the programs that are greatly affected by aging population. Nobody wants to go out and tell Americans retired that, guess what, we're going to cut these benefits that you've been paying for. And then there's Medicaid, which is the health care program for the poor. And, you know, as it stands, we don't like to, we want to make promises but don't want to pay for them. It's a badly managed program. It's hard to imagine how you're going to cut that spending. And then there's military spending. So it's hard to imagine, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now, how you're going to convince Americans that the programs we should cut are Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, while we're helping defend lots of allies who we keep wondering why aren't they paying more themselves. And I think this is going to start driving American military spending. And if you're going to look at military spending, it's far better to look at your foreign policy first. I tell people the military budget is the price of your foreign policy. The more you promise, then the more force structure you've got to have. My nephew's a SEAL. I mean, this is kind of the carbon fiber tip, right, of the spear. My reaction is you don't send him somewhere overseas in harm's way unless you have the men and materiel to back him up. So we need to start now thinking about what America is going to be doing in the world today, next year, 10 years from now. And I think that's why we've got to start looking at Europe. That it's hard to see how almost 80 years after the end of World War II, where Europe has more than three times the population of Russia, something like 10 times the economic strength of Russia, it already spends around three times as much on the military. It doesn't spend it well, but it spends a relative lot compared to Russia, why it can't defend itself. We need to start looking at Europe as a place where it's up to the Europeans in the future to kind of care for their own security. And yet, if what has happened since last year is the Biden administration has put more than 20,000 more American troops in Europe. It's promised that the U.S. will defend every inch of NATO territory. The U.S. has promoted the expansion of NATO. And at the recent NATO meeting, Ukraine came in demanding yet again that it wants to be part of NATO. But if we want to be part of NATO means it wants us to be prepared for a war to defend them, which no one has wanted. So I think this is a good moment for us to step back and say, how do we ensure that the Europeans do what they've been promising to do, which is do more? Because frankly, they've been stepping back from those promises. There was a lot of rhetoric last year. Even the British, even the Germans have been stepping back. We've got to find a way to push that forward, as opposed to leave Americans on the hook forever, essentially for the European welfare state. I don't care how the Europeans spend their money, but we shouldn't have to subsidize their choices by basically providing them defense welfare when they can be doing that on their own.
Well, Doug, let's take a look at what the war between Ukraine and Russia has exposed about NATO, so to speak. In other words, what has it shown about NATO that we didn't really fully appreciate before this war broke out and all of this support was given to Ukraine?
Well, what we've seen is that at some level, the European countries are hollow shells when it comes to the military. The United Kingdom has, I think the number is 227 Challenger tanks, of which they offered something like 14 to the Ukrainians. I mean, that's extraordinary. I mean, Germany, we've kind of been aware, but, you know, there have been parliamentary reports, for example, come out of Germany looking at readiness levels, looking at the number of submarines and planes that actually function, looking at the lack of, you know, very basic gear, winter gear and other things for their troops. At one point, some of the training was being conducted with wooden sticks as opposed to rifles. You know, so, and all of that's been brought into very sharp relief in terms of who's helping the Ukrainians. The U.S., of course, has provided vastly more than anyone else. The U.S. has provided more than Europe collectively. And what the Europeans are finding is they go into their storage rooms and their equipment, you know, it's rusted away, it's not functional, it's not working. Germany today has, you know, its military is in worse shape than last year because it hasn't replaced anything that it gave the Ukrainians. That we've seen, I think, very dramatically how much the Europeans really did rely on the U.S. Even when they spent money to try to hit some target, they didn't spend it well. And now it's been exposed as, you know, what are they doing? I mean, the expectation is the U.S. will step in. That's always been the expectation.
There are recent reports that the Ukrainian military forces are in trouble because they're running short, of course, on artillery rounds, but as significant, they're running short on missile anti-aircraft defenses, which should they run out of those, then Russia gets to dominate the skies and they're in really serious trouble.
And the problem with this is, of course, they want more from us and they want more from the Europeans. is that, frankly, we and the Europeans can't provide them. I mean, we don't have the production capacity for artillery shells. And one of the problems with Ukrainians, of course, is they have a lot of older Soviet models. That's not the kind of artillery we make. But even if we had, you know, we were making shells, we don't make nearly enough. That's the fear of, in terms of you know, Stinger missiles and other things that we've been providing, is we've run down the U.S. arsenal. What happens if actually we ended up in a real war today? That production capacity, you know, simply isn't there. Now, the Europeans came together and decided they were going to come up with a collective mechanism to build artillery shells. A couple of weeks ago, they announced with great fanfare they'd agreed to this. Yet we find that they're still hung up on the issue of, are they only going to rely on European Union producers or not? So now suddenly this has become an economic issue. Everyone says the Ukrainians are in dire need of artillery shells, and the Europeans are arguing over, okay, now which producers get to make them? You know, do we go outside the European Union? So you get that sense that they're simply not treating this seriously. Yet their cupboards were relatively bare to begin with. That which they've given to the Ukrainians has drawn all of that down. No one knows when it's going to be filled up, yet they're arguing over issues like this. And it's a very real problem. Trying to understand what's going on in the war, of course, is not easy because everything is seen through kind of a Ukrainian prism. Now, I think the Russians behaved awful. I mean, that there should be no doubt that this was, you know, a wretched aggression and that the Russians are at fault. Nevertheless, it's critical for the United States and Europe to have an understanding of what's going on, which requires kind of looking at both sides and trying to get a more objective look. I'm afraid that our information sources have been somewhat tainted, so it's hard to get the information in terms of, well, what is the status of manpower for the Ukrainians, artillery, and other sorts of things? We need that for our planning.
Well, we know in terms of the U.S. industrial base that the munitions, which were drawn down to a dangerous extent, that replenishing the cruise missiles, replenishing the anti-aircraft weapons, it's not a matter of 6 months, it's a matter of years, like 3 years. Simply there aren't enough production lines to replace these or keep up this pace of disbursement. So my question to you regarding NATO countries is, do they have the industrial base to do this, or has that likewise been eroded by moving so many things to China?
Well, I mean, their industrial base has also, you know, kind of dropped dramatically on the military side. Part of that, of course, is the U.S. presses them to buy U.S. weapons. We understand that's understandable from the standpoint of wanting that money to come to the U.S., but it also means the Europeans produce fewer weapons themselves. So they don't have the capacity. I mean, that really is the scary thing. I mean, the Germans have spent virtually nothing of the supposed 100 billion euro fund that was set up. I mean, it's a very convoluted process. You have to let the contract, somebody has to start building them, etc. None of the weapons that have gone last year have been replaced. You know, the other countries are frankly in no better shape here. And a lot of what we see out of Europe are promises for the future. You know, the French have come up with a new plan. They said by 2030, don't worry, we're going to be spending a third more than today. Well, you can promise anything you want in 2030. We've seen that. You know, the Europeans back in 2014 said by 2024, everybody's supposed to have 2% of GDP on the military. Seven countries do that. That includes the U.S. and Greece. And Greece is arming against Turkey, not Russia. It's down one from last year. Now, lots of countries plan to get to 2%. But we've seen how that works. It never seems to get there.
Well, one of the reactions because of the shock into which Europe went with the Russian invasion is that now, finally, they will take their defense spending obligations to NATO seriously. And of course, Germany was making very determined statements that they were going to do that, the United Kingdom and so forth. But as you point out, what has happened subsequent to that is that they've backed off those commitments.
That's right. At one point, London said 3% of GDP. Oh no, now suddenly they discovered they have financial trouble. Well, we do too. You know, so now you know, the new prime minister says there's kind of an aspirational desire to get to 2.5%. Okay, that's very nice. But are they actually going to get there? I mean, on the Germans, the way they've interpreted this 100 billion euro fund and spread it out, the current numbers suggest that by 2026, they'll be spending less than they spent last year. And the Social Democrats, the chancellor is a Social Democrat. Social Democrats are not happy at the idea of this major spending increase. They've got a three-party coalition. It's a very complicated political situation. And I suspect that if the war would end next year, the question is how many of those promises would then be fulfilled? The moment you pull off that impetus, it's the incentive there, that if the wolf is not at the door, I think you go back to doing what you've done in the past. So if we see the Europeans backing away over this past year when the war is still raging, that tells us we shouldn't expect an awful lot in the future unless we add some incentive to it. As long as we do it, we rush troops in, we provide most of the aid, we constantly reassure the Europeans, don't worry, we're there, we'll do everything for you. Why would a rational European policymaker want to spend their money on defense when they know they can rely on the U.S.?
Well, we know that to a certain extent, membership in NATO has meant a decline in the defense spending of the nations that have acceded to membership, with this attitude that we're under the U.S. nuclear umbrella and the largest military in NATO, and they'll take care of us. And the trade-off for the United States is that allows us to more or less control policy.
That's right. The U.S. has long been horrified at the thought the Europeans would have an independent military, foreign policy, international approach. And, from our standpoint is we want them to do more, but only as we tell them. We want them to do more in a way that we want them to do it. And it just doesn't work that way. That in the end, if you demand that, then you're going to end up paying for most of it. And now I think that may be good for people in Washington, that if we control them. Now, we actually don't, of course. I mean, it turns out it's very hard to make other countries do anything. For the most part, what happens is they simply do less, so the U.S. plays a larger role. That's the form of control. It's not so much bringing them along in a major way, but rather they don't resist the U.S. But I think if you look at the world we're in, we're going to have to start making priorities. And to my mind, if you're looking around the world and saying, where is the most serious challenge? It's not Russia. I mean, Russia, in my view, is a declining power. And it's shown that by its inability to defeat Ukraine. The rhetoric of, oh my, if Ukraine is defending Europe, if Ukraine loses, the Russians will be marching down the streets of Paris. I mean, this is just silly. That's not going to happen.
Doug, you mentioned the wolf, right? Your allusion to Russia. And you began your remarks by saying that the first thing to look at is foreign policy and put everything in the context of that. So we know in the history of NATO that it was obviously created to protect, at that time, Western Europe from further Soviet expansion, as they had a very powerful Warsaw Pact facing a relatively weak NATO. And therefore, the U.S. nuclear umbrella was all the more important. So one could see how that made sense because the Soviet Union was the great geopolitical challenge we were facing. But then after 91, when the Soviet Union collapses, NATO takes a huge leap in membership to the point now that if Sweden accedes to NATO, there will be 32 countries.
That's right.
As against the original 12 from 1949. Now, let me give a counterpoising opinion from quite a respected foreign policy writer, Robert Kaplan, which he had in the Wall Street Journal about a week and a half ago. So he's very much for the expansion of NATO. He said this, had the West not expanded NATO and the EU to the East, we would now be fighting for Poland instead of for Ukraine and Belarus, as Mr. Putin surely would be breathing down the neck of every country between Berlin and Moscow. Germany would have drifted further toward neutralism, requiring a close relationship with Russia, not only for natural gas, but to manage its borders with Poland and the Czech Republic, etc. We are now fighting to complete the Intermarium, Latin for between the seas, that is, the Baltic and Black Seas, a belt of democratic states from Estonia in the north to Ukraine in the south to protect against Russian imperialism. So Mr. Kaplan here makes very clear who the wolf is, and he's describing the nature of the threat from Russia very differently from what you just have. And he's observed the very same things in the Ukraine-Russia war that we have. So what is your reaction to Kaplan's statement?
Well, my first reaction is that he views alliances differently. I view alliances as something that's supposed to enhance American security. I think he views an alliance as something that's supposed to promote democracy. It's supposed to have, at some level, his view of an alliance is international welfare. That is, you protect countries that might be weaker. I mean, that's a kind of a nice thing to do. The question is, are we prepared to go to war for that? I mean, if you look at the expansion of NATO, the U.S. has brought on countries that are security black holes. I mean, Montenegro doesn't add to American security. The Baltic states didn't add to American security. That if what you're doing is bringing on obligations rather than strengths, you know, you're enhancing America's weaknesses, quite frankly. You're putting the U.S. at greater risk, making promises to go to war for countries that aren't essential for America's defense. The original NATO, it kind of came out of World War II in the sense that you go to war between the Nazis and the communists to ensure that neither side is able to dominate Eurasia. That is something the U.S. did not want to have happen. That's why the U.S. wanted to ensure the protection of Western Europe after the war. But nobody during the Cold War imagined that if the U.S. was not protecting Ukraine, that the U.S. would be extra vulnerable. I mean, there was a sense of what the fundamental American interest was, Western Europe, and you protect that. And I think that's the first point, is that to make claims like that, well, the question is, what is the relevance of some of those countries to American security? Do we imagine the world that he's imagining America as under greater threat? I don't really see that. The second is, I think he's simply wrong in the sense of Putin's motivations. Now, you know, Vladimir Putin is not a nice guy. I mean, we should have no illusions about him being some, you know, pro-family, whatever, conservative, you know, some of the stuff that we've seen out there. I mean, this is a ruthless guy, former, you know, KGB. Nevertheless, there is no evidence that he was particularly anti-American. You know, the KGB were the cynics. I mean, he'd been in Eastern Germany. You know, they had a higher standard of living than the Soviet Union. He was did not appear to be particularly hostile to the U.S. when he took power. He was the first president who called George W. Bush after 9/11 to offer assistance. And I tell people, it's very interesting. You read his speech in 2001 to the German Bundestag. He really wanted a relationship with the West. He talked about how he recognized that there is a relationship between Europe and the United States. And you got a very different kind of tone from him. And then 2007, when he gave a speech before the Munich Security Conference. And I think we underestimated how important it was, not only him, but the Russian public, is they perceived aggressiveness from the West. That is, lots of assurances, and we have those assurances all over the documents that have been declassified out of the end of the Cold War, that the U.S. and allies made promises that NATO wouldn't expand, and it did. When the Baltic states came in, the border of NATO is about 100 miles from St. Petersburg, you know, the old Leningrad during World War II. The opinion of both elite Russians and the public turned very negative when the U.S. dismembered Kosovo. You know, I mean, without UN approval. I mean, this is, so the talk about NATO being a defensive alliance, well, when it went out of area, it became offensive. They saw the same in Libya. The idea of the color revolutions in both Tbilisi and Kyiv, as well as 2014, essentially a street putsch against an elected president. Corrupt one, without question, but elected in what were widely considered essentially free elections, generally pro-Russian in his approach. So all of that, you know, the West just kind of sweeps that away. And I think the Russians saw that in a much more provocative light. So that gave them a very different vision of what was going on. And Putin has always been very concerned about Ukraine in a way that he has not talked about any of this. I've seen nothing to suggest that the Russians have any interest in war with Poland.
Well, it's interesting, Kaplan's very strong statement in this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. You could simply substitute the Soviet Union for the word Russia, and it would read as a powerful Cold War document. So the question is really, concerning the wolf, is what kind of nation is Russia? Now, David Satter, who has been on this program a number of times, I personally consider the most brilliant and insightful American writer, as he was for many years on the Soviet Union and on Russia. His many books are simply brilliant. From his experiences there, he makes the strong case that Russia is not a normal country. it has not recovered from the massive distortions imposed from, 70 years of Marxist-Leninist. I mean, I'm sure you were there at some point.
Yes.
And I made several trips to the Soviet Union in the last years of its existence. And it was bizarre. It was a completely bizarre place. Tremendous amount of not just material damage, but spiritual damage. And so David Satter doesn't expect Russia to behave normally because they're not normal. What do you take of that perspective?
Well, I guess part of the question is what is normal? I mean, countries going to war and seizing territory is hardly abnormal given the human experience. It strikes me that, to me, Russia looks like a pre-1914 great power, kind of their old Russian Empire, which would be, it would take advantage of circumstances, that it could be aggressive if it suited it. But it wasn't something that had kind of a vision of ideological conquest. And I think that's, to my mind, the very great difference from the Soviet Union. I mean, Joseph Stalin demonstrated in the aftermath of World War II the expansion of Soviet troops, that wherever Soviet troops ended up, almost, at least anywhere, I mean, Austria they pulled out, but for the most part, where Soviet troops went, the Soviet Union ended up in terms of influence. And I don't think Russia, part of it is that Russia's kind of resources and abilities are substantially less than the Soviet Union. And I don't get a sense that that Putin has ideologically driven in any way the same way. So I'd certainly say, number one, expecting this to become a democracy, we shouldn't. That it doesn't mean it can't at some point. But, Moscow, this ruling, I mean, in essence, Soviet Union was the Russian Empire, in certain ways just reimagined with a new ideology. We haven't had a democratic Russia in history. And I think you're absolutely right that what that has done to a national character, civil society, the spiritual, I mean, the underpinnings of a society, the ability to work together, I mean, all of these things are clearly affected by that. So I would assume this is going to be a difficult, problematic neighbor. It doesn't mean, however, it's bent on military aggression, especially, I think, now that it's shown, frankly, it's not very competent at that. And to me, that's the real issue here, then. However we imagine Russia, can the Europeans defend themselves? And after 80 years after World War II, I would say, yes, they can. But we've got to make it clear to them that's going to be their obligation. That we shouldn't assume just because Russia's a malign actor, the U.S. has to defend them. It has to be a new approach of defense. And I think the idea of the U.S., to the extent it can become an arsenal of democracy, it can be certainly an arsenal, it can help the Europeans if there was in fact a conflict. But that doesn't mean the U.S. has to be on the front lines guarding the Europeans in the future.
You mentioned the Baltic states entering NATO wasn't a plus in terms of security. I was reading the Cato Institute's paper, Why the U.S. Efforts at Defense Burden Sharing Fail. It's a very well-done presentation. One of the striking remarks in it is that while the Baltic states joined NATO in 2004, NATO did not have a plan to defend them until 2010. This isn't serious. I mean, this means NATO itself didn't think Russia was much of a wolf, or certainly they would have, or that they regarded NATO as something other than this defense alliance.
Well, I think that what happened in those years, especially kind of Clinton administration into the George W. Bush years, was that the view was Russia had lost, or the Soviet Union had lost, so they could be pushed around, and that there wasn't a threat, so you could bring countries in as, it became almost kind of like a gentleman's club, right? Everybody wants to be part of the club. So of course you bring them in. I mean, if you look at the Baltic states, the question is how do you defend them from Russia? And I don't think anyone's simply bothered to ask, is it serious for us to make that promise? If we make that promise, how do we act on it? If we act on it, do we win? And those are all questions that should have been asked. And I think the problem is, to some degree, NATO gave a false promise to the Baltic states, which is, well, of course, NATO will take care of us. Now, they're small. I mean, it's at one level, they can't defend themselves. But Even now, they spend, 2%, a little more than 2% of GDP on the military. My reaction would be, if you're next door to this Russia and you're weak and you're worried about your defense, you need a strong territorial defense. Well, that means 5% of GDP. Maybe it's 10%. I mean, what you do is you decide. You're seriously worried about the Russians. You've got to make it very clear to the Russians they will pay a price. That you're not going to be, this is not something where you just kind of stroll on in and they take it. And I think that then again, it's not our obligation to do that. They should be at least a starting point. And my reaction at this is, we've made the promise to defend them. They're part of NATO. That's our promise. But they should be able to, they should do more and shouldn't expect everyone else to do more just for them. They need to do more as well. And I'd like to see that, because you look at a map, they're not particularly defensible. Now, they're helped to some degree with Finland in. It helps change the geography a bit. Nevertheless, it would still be difficult to defend them. I haven't seen anything to suggest that Putin has any particular interest in conquering them. I don't think he doesn't view them in some ways integral to Russia. But, they should be on their guard. If they're very concerned, and I think they are, they need to do more themselves.
Well, as you know, those three countries do spend 2% of their GDP, but the question is 2% of what? So Lithuania has, the largest of the three Baltic countries, has 23,000 troops, by far the largest. How large is the pie of which this is 2%? For the United States, that means a lot, though we spend a good deal more than 2%. This really does seem to boil down, Doug, to a perspective on the nature of Russia today. Is it the same kind of, is there something imperial in the Russian blood that will lead it to take advantage of any weakness to the nations to its west so that someday it would threaten Poland again? And that seems to be the big divide.
I mean, I look at it as Putin has been president for more than 23 years, or about, I guess, what was it, December of 1999, I think, he took over as president. He is no Adolf Hitler. He's no Joseph Stalin. I mean, his conquests, if you want to call them that, to the extent you count kind of indirect control over territory, would be South Ossetia and Abkhazia, right, the Donbass, and Crimea. That's frankly not much of a record of conquest. So I look at that, I mean, everything I think we've seen in his behavior, he's a predator, but a rational and controlled one. Everyone was shocked by the invasion of Ukraine. I think that's kind of shows the judgment there, that his past behavior did not suggest that this is part of some massive attempt to overrun Europe. And I think the notion that if he defeated the Ukrainians, that he would immediately line up the troops and off they would go again. And I think you look at Ukraine and the map and you understand the security concerns there. And again, he is absolutely wrong in what he did. But it's worth recognizing, I've always thought strategic empathy is worth playing. That is, if you flip things around. And if you imagine Russia did essentially what the U.S. did. That is, imagine that Russia expands the Warsaw Pact to South America. That Russia helps stage a coup d'etat in Mexico City against an elected Mexican president, friendly to the United States. That Russian officials are then on the loose around Mexico City, found on their phones talking about who they want in the Mexican government. And that Russia invites Mexico to join the Warsaw Pact. What would the reaction in Washington be? It would not be friendly. And again, it doesn't justify what he did, but I think it helps us understand at least a little bit more of what was going on. And I don't think that we see that kind of an attitude towards Poland. They fought Poland before. They fought Poland after, the World War I ended, and they didn't do well. And the idea that they would want to rule Poles, I think that's just very, they took all the territory they wanted after World War II. They grabbed the eastern part of Poland. So it's hard for me to imagine what that agenda would be. That it looks to me like this is an effort, they want essentially what the U.S. has, which is sphere of influence. And unfortunately, he chose war as a way to get it. But it's hard for me to see that notion that he actually thinks he could conquer Europe and would make an effort. And I just don't think it's possible.
As certain military analysts have pointed out, Doug, the number of troops he used to invade Ukraine was way below what would have been needed to occupy a country of that size. So it didn't look like the plan was to occupy it. On the other hand, because of faulty intelligence or whatever other reason, because he thinks they're his Slavic brothers and would welcome the Russian troops, they could simply replace Zelensky, install a friendly government, and it would be over. Well, it turned out quite the opposite. It's interesting with this extraordinarily courageous defense by the Ukrainians. And people who wonder, is Ukraine a nation? Well, the Ukrainians have now spoken by the sacrifices they've been willing to make. And the answer is a resounding, oh, yes, we are. And of course, he's undergone several mobilization calls to try to get more Russians under arms, simply to keep the part of Ukraine conquered. And NATO's response is to create this 300,000 sort of rapid reaction force, which is very far from achieving now. So let's say the war comes to some kind of negotiated settlement. How likely do you find it that NATO would keep its commitment to create this 300,000 quickly mobilized army to face any future threat from Russia? Is that, I mean, I find it hard to think now that they could mobilize 300,000 troops.
You know, the irony of all of this is that Vladimir Putin essentially created intensified Ukrainian nationalism. And that started in 2014. You know, in the previous, Yanukovych, the man who was thrown out in 2014, was elected very heavy support in the East. Yeah, because, Galicia, kind of old territories of Austro-Hungary and everything, were joined with Ukraine after World War I. And you look at a map of voting patterns, the further east you got, the stronger the support for candidates seen as relatively pro-Russian. I mean, none of them wanted to be ruled from Moscow, but a question of friendliness and economic connections, as well as whether you want to be part of NATO or whatever, varied dramatically. And after 2014, I mean, what you found was, in terms of public polls and whatnot, support for Russia dropped dramatically, even in those areas where, in the past, people perceived them as being pro-Russian. And at this stage, there's virtually nothing left. I mean, the polls all indicate, I think, that the Donbass, after the Russians and the separatists backed by Russia took over, support for Russia dropped dramatically. In Crimea, I mean, they may still have a majority of people who genuinely want to stay with Russia, though, Tartars have been pushed out. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's happened. It's hard to
understand.
Exactly. Yeah. And even, after the takeover in 2014, there's been some of...
To Russify.
That's right. So trying to figure out what the sentiment of people there is a little more complicated. But Crimea was always a special case, having historically been Russian for a long time. So Putin has created the Ukrainian nation that he didn't want. And I think, to me, one of the telling points, as you indicated, is that I believe he thought he could go in and just decapitate the government, put in a pro-Russian one, and get what he wanted without an occupation, without running the country, which suggests to me that he knows that wouldn't happen elsewhere in Europe, that his intentions in Ukraine were a more limited form. And if that were his intentions there, it's hard to imagine he'd have this expansive, form elsewhere. But the problem for the Europeans is they will act only if they have to act. So I'm not even convinced this 300,000 person force is serious now. Again, look at what they're doing on spending, look at backing away on things. Just a year into the war, we're seeing that kind of, we have economic problems. I mean, well, doesn't the U.S., when they all look to America, well, don't we have problems as well?
I just throw in another statistic, Doug, from this Cato Institute publication, which tracks the percentage of the defense burdens the United States vis-a-vis the other NATO members. And the United States contribution is above 60%. And the other NATO countries are below 40. And it appears that they have never risen to above that. They've never broken 40%.
And they've never had to.
And they've never had to. Well, the thing is, do they think they have to now?
No. I mean, to me, that seems pretty clear. And I think, again, the problem is if you rush in extra U.S. troops, you promise to defend every part of territory, you welcome expansion of NATO, you're communicating to the Europeans that NATO remains a central American security concern.
Sacred, exactly. As President Biden.
That's right. I mean, I was always struck by presidents. I mean, Robert Gates, Defense Secretary, and others have these scorching speeches about the Europeans not doing what they should be doing. And then, the vice president was one, and others would go over and we would be told they're on a reassurance mission to reassure the Europeans. In fact, Congress passed what they called the Reassurance Initiative, a multi-billion dollar spending program, rotating more troops through. But what did that communicate? We want you to do more, but don't worry, we're always going to be there for you. I think what's an interesting comparison is Japan. And in fact, the paper by Justin Logan, one of Cato's foreign policy scholars, mentions this. And it's a very telling one, in my view. If you look at what's happening in Japan today, a very serious talk of doubling spending as a percentage of GDP. And while it may not get all the way there, again, they have their own political processes to go through, et cetera, that you get a sense that what Japan is being animated, number one, by the perception of a greater threat with China and North Korea. And second, by a certain nervousness about whether the U.S. will always be there and whether we are really serious about extended deterrence. Are we prepared to sacrifice American cities to protect their cities? Their response then is to do more, that they recognize that's a circumstance. They don't want to be totally reliant on the U.S. So to my mind, that's what's lacking in Europe. One of the administration officials last year said, yeah, we want them to do more, but we are not prepared to say or else. If you don't say or else, they have no logical reason to behave otherwise. I don't blame them. If the U.S. could get somebody else to pay for our defense, I'd say that's wonderful. And during the Cold War, as they're recovering, there really was the shield behind which they would recover. But, even Dwight Eisenhower said, we failed if U.S. troops are there forever, if we become like Rome and permanent employment, deployments of forces. And that's what we did.
Apparently, there's a new phrase circulating in Japan referring to our current time as the new pre-war. So the signs are there, and they greatly appreciate the threat to them. And as you know, the changes in defense policy in Japan, as well as the spending, are historic, considering the kind of nation it's been since 1946. Let's go back to Europe and the NATO situation and the EU situation. The economic warfare waged against Russia has simply been extraordinary. No or very minimal purchases of Russian natural gas. Huge thing for Germany to have undertaken that and to have done it in such a way with our help that it didn't bring their industry down, which so much of which relies on natural gas supplies. No oil from Russia. The withdrawal from Russia of almost all the major Western corporations. Right. Now is that a permanent feature of the landscape? Is that going to remain even after some kind of cessation of this Russia-Ukraine war?
Well, certainly the Europeans are going to be, I think, reluctant to become so dependent on Russia, whatever the future looks like.
So they've learned their lesson?
That I think they have. I mean, they were very lucky that it was a relatively mild winter. If it had been a much colder winter, they would have had much greater problems. But I think that everyone there, doesn't mean they wouldn't go back and start buying some Russian energy, but I suspect that notion that you become so heavily dependent, where they literally can kind of shut you off, they don't want to go. And look, and to some degree in the future, I suspect Russia is going to be still providing more to Asian and others, that a lot of these markets have changed in a way. If I was Russia, I'd probably prefer to be reliant on Asian customers who aren't likely to sanction me and cut me off. So some of that, I think, you know, we're seeing like the U.S., China, the question of supply chains. I think the European situation, it's a different kind of issue, but in many ways coming to the same conclusion. I think the real issue of sanctions on financial transactions, technology, and everything else, that's going to become a really huge issue. I think if you want some kind of a solution, let us assume that militarily neither side can win, kind of however we want to define win, but for the most part, the Russians cannot defeat on the battlefield Ukraine and take Kyiv and put in a new government, and the Ukrainians are not in a position to fully defeat Russian forces and retake the Donbass and Crimea. So we're something like the lines of today are there next year. How do you get out of this? I mean, it requires a negotiated settlement. Sanctions have to be at least part of the discussion. No one wants to reward aggression. On the other hand, do we really want to have an isolated, angry, revanchist Russia, you know, where in a sense we've got a great big North Korea just with a lot more nuclear weapons and other, you know, tools of destruction? I'm not sure we want to be there either. And frankly, one of the most powerful sanctions on the Russians have been the loss of a technocratic elite, you know, liberal professionals.
Their own people leaving.
That's right. Now, on the one hand, we may like that in the theory that we're degrading and weakening Russia. On the other hand, to the extent that the whole system becomes more nationalistic, more limited, more reliant on the worst people. I mean, Putin is a bad guy, but he is not the most radical nationalist there. If he fell, it wouldn't be a Jeffersonian Democrat who took over. Probably be somebody a good bit worse out of the security services. So I'm not sure we want an isolated Russia over the long term either. So this, I think part of the, we need a discussion in the West of how we would want to approach this. And I think we probably need to have that issue as part of any negotiated settlement to offer the Russians. Come up with a settlement that Ukraine can live with, and, you know, sanctions relief goes as part of that. That one has to, if you tell them they will never get out of sanctions, they, you know, then you give them another incentive to say, well, what, fine. I mean, we're going to go our own way. We're going to do what we want in Ukraine, et cetera. Give them an opportunity. Because I think over the long term, what will particularly hurt them are some of the technology controls. They can evade, you know, and stuff. I mean, buying washing machines and pulling chips out. But over the long term, I think that's the high-tech energy industry. There are some of these things they really need that 10, 20 years from now, I think that will...
Highly, highly damaging,
yes,
to them.
Exactly.
To lose that access to high,
yes,
technology from the West. Well, so let's talk for a minute about the Russian perspective. As you know, when Putin took Ukraine back in 2014, it was a wildly popular move in Russia. A few Russians I talked to they were so puzzled by the reaction in the United States and West, saying, well, you know, what's the problem? It is Russian. It's always been Russian. This greatly enhanced Vladimir Putin's popularity, and with that popularity gives him even more power to maneuver. Now, it's very hard to judge rightly what is the level of Putin's popularity now, because it's hard to have some kind of free and accurate polling, though there are some indications that his popularity has been maintained, that the Russian people do have a siege mentality after sort of the relentless eastward expansion of NATO. They have all asked themselves the question, well, what is it defending against?
Right.
And the obvious answer is us.
Yep.
So we're their enemy. So likewise, we should think of them as the enemy, right? And that instills in a nation a deep, deep sense of grievance.
That's right.
Serious powers, which Russia still is, with a deep sense of grievance, are more dangerous. We know that China today also has this deep sense of historical, yeah, grievance. They're a non-status quo power with deep grievances. It makes them exceptionally dangerous, just as was Germany after World War I, which Hitler was able to play into, and that, to say the least, was exceedingly dangerous. So it's hard to see how that damage can be ameliorated. That's one point. My second point, Doug, is any settlement of the war on Ukraine's side would certainly, from their perspective, require some security assurances to Ukraine. Now, you know how repeatedly Ukraine has been told by NATO, and particularly by the United States, you will become a member. Immediately, like the day after the Russian invasion, Zelensky said, oh, we'll forswear NATO forever. Well, that's a time short and a day too late, unfortunately. And now, of course, things have changed and will not go back to this status quo ante. What can be reasonably expected in terms of guarantees for Ukraine's security to help bring this war to an end?
You know, on the first point, I think it's very important not to set as a goal defeating Russia, humiliating Russia, ousting Putin, etc. I mean, all of those sound pretty good in the abstract, but the question is always compared to what? You oust Putin, well, then who takes over? We have to accept we are not in a situation where we would expect better. So it's an absolute wild card. So it's one thing to take policy, make policy, and recognize it could happen. It's another thing to set as your goal to make it happen. And I think particularly the isolation of Russia, that what I fear is, exactly, you get yourself, you know, we don't want another Versailles Treaty, where you have a post-World War I Germany, which basically is consumed with the injustice that they perceived and wanting recompense. We don't want a Russia that does. So, Tom, I mean, that's one reason why that, you know, for all of the talk, we must defeat them, we must, all these things, and maybe they'll fall apart, etc. And my reaction is, would you have wanted do we want another Yugoslavia, only bigger and with 5,000 nuclear weapons? Do we want multiple civil wars across? Again, to my mind, this is extraordinarily dangerous. That be very careful what you wish for. So that's why I think we have to bring into any negotiating process of how do we figure out to get Russia back into a family of nations. Especially, we have to recognize that much of the world doesn't really care about Ukraine. That there are an awful lot of countries out there. You look by population. I mean, the majority. Yeah. You know, and, I mean, Pakistan and Indonesia. I mean, there's a whole Nigeria. I mean, South Africa. I mean, all of these countries that, from their standpoint, they look and say, you guys blew up Iraq. You had an illegal war. You committed aggression. You killed people. And now you're... And they look at themselves and say, you know, millions of people died in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Well, you didn't come and save them. And, you know, you've had your other wars and whatnot. So Russia has clearly kind of staked this sense that it has an alternative to the West, that it can write the West off. I don't think we want that. I mean, I think that, so it's going to be difficult. The question of Ukraine, part of it is we can't tell Ukraine what its objectives are. But the U.S. should calibrate its support, recognizing, you know, I mean, how do you try to... We need to make clear to the Ukrainians that they can't demand everything and expect that we're going to provide the weapons to do that. I mean, I joke, what if the Ukrainians announced they wanted to seize Moscow, you know, and hold it until they got the settlement they want? Well, we would have to say, that's not happening, right? I mean, we're not... So to my mind is, part of this is going to have to be a discussion where the Ukrainians understand that... They can set whatever objectives they want. That doesn't mean it's in America's interest to give them everything, you know, they want. You know, so my view in terms of our security interest is ensuring independence of Ukraine. That doesn't mean the U.S. has a particular objective in terms of what territory they control, what's the status of Crimea or anything else. Those are things that matter a lot to Ukraine. They don't matter much, you know, to the United States. The question of security assurances is going to be very difficult. The reality is NATO spent 14 years lying to the Ukrainians. In 2008, yes, we love you, we're going to bring you in. And for 14 years, NATO said, yes, we love you, we're going to bring you in. But no one in NATO wanted to bring them in because no one in NATO wanted to defend them. I mean, that's why we're not defending them now directly. You know, I mean, Zelensky would love to have the U.S. in that war. You know, when the Ukrainian missile hit in Poland, he tried to lie us into the war. I mean, let's face it, if the American military and Polish military knew that missile was Ukrainian, surely the Ukrainian military knew that. You know, he was trying to use that to get the Allies in. I don't blame him. I mean, if I was him, I'd do the same. So, you know, if the Europeans and Americans really don't want to have to defend Ukraine, then the question is, can you construct something, essentially say you get what you got now, that is, we will continue to arm you, train your forces, help you build a military, which the Russians will realize if they stalemated us before, it happened again. That, you know, rather than a direct military commitment to come in, it would be a commitment to ensure that you have the means to defend yourself, but any war would be fought by you. I'm not convinced. I mean, the recent NATO summit, the Ukrainians were there and very insistent, saying, we don't just want assurances, blah, 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 we want. And nobody would give it to them. Stoltenberg, you know, Director General, and all the others are, well, that's something to talk about in the future. We want to focus on defense now. What means they don't want to talk about it because they're not prepared to make that commitment. That's going to be a real sticking point.
Well, you know, shortly after the war began, and it was evident that the Russian version of Blitzkrieg was a disaster, a Ukrainian said about Russia, they're 7 years too late.
Yeah.
And of course, what he was alluding to was the heavy Western presence in Ukraine to upgrade their military, to train them and make them a more capable fighting force, to arm them. And the fruit of that is, of course, how well they have fought.
Exactly. Now, I mean, the joke on that was, you know, they weren't able to get into NATO, but NATO was able to get into Ukraine.
Yes.
And that had a huge impact.
Yeah. I remember reading Vladimir Putin's, 7,000, 8,000 word essay in the summer before the war saying the way Russian, or at least Putin, view Ukraine as historical ties to Russia that are unbreakable. And Ukraine can live with that, whatever kind of government it so chooses, but it cannot be hostile to Russia. A number of people said his history is way off base, and one could see it as part of information warfare, or Putin could actually have meant it. Someone we both know, who's Russian, who worked closely with Putin for years, said, no, that's, yeah, he does mean it. He is serious about this kind of thing. Well, now, Doug, because of what has happened, it doesn't seem that there's any way in the world that sine qua non requirement of Putin that Ukraine not be a nation hostile to Russia. That's not achievable now, because the Ukrainians are not going to forget this and the terrible devastation that the Russian military forces have delivered upon their country.
Yeah, I mean, all I can see of Russia achieving would be some sort of a modus vivendi in which the, you know, Ukraine agrees not to be part of NATO, which would then sever at least the theoretical ability to be some kind of an offensive force against Russia. And that Putin could present that as a success in having reached, you know, an outcome in which the, you know, Kyiv has agreed it will not join with this organization, which, you know, Putin and other Russians view as kind of an aggressive threat. I mean, from a Russian standpoint, this has been an utter disaster.
It's been an utter disaster militarily in the number of resources that sucked out of Russia. And of course, as you pointed out, the economic retaliation that Western powers have taken. But there's still this big difference. Ukraine was never a vital national security interest to the United States. It's always been a vital national security interest to Russia. And that is why Putin repeatedly has said, no, that's a red line. That we will never accept that. Of course, he wasn't taken seriously. So Not that he was justified in his views, mind you, but you listen to the leader of one of the world powers, and he said that's a red line over which we'll go to war, and then he goes to war, and you shouldn't be surprised, at least, right? This is why I think so many people are worried about escalation, Doug, because no matter the damage the Russian forces have received, he shows no signs of backing off, and there have been threats of escalation. And while his conventional military forces have shown to be in a lamentable condition, because of the widespread corruption, I don't think this is true of his strategic forces. And where he's put the real Russian money is in the modernization of the nuclear forces, of hypersonic missiles, of the latest Russian fighter aircraft. Those are serious. And if he thinks that vital national security interest is continuing to be endangered, what do you think of that chance of escalation?
Now, I think you've pointed out really the essential issue here, which is intensity matters. That is, from an American standpoint, we have humanitarian interests and a lot of other things in Ukraine. We don't have a fundamental security interest. The U.S. never in its history was concerned about Moscow's role in Ukraine. No one talked, the Soviet Union, we were worried about the Soviet Union, but there's no focus on Ukraine. The Russian Empire, I mean, never. So the U.S. will not fight directly over Ukraine. The president has made that very clear, and I think he believes that very strongly, that he does not see an American interest that warrants direct conflict with Russia. But as you indicated, for Russia, this is a vital interest. I mean, it's why the U.S. won, if you want to put it that way, the Cuban Missile Crisis. For the U.S., having Soviet missiles in Cuba off of America's coast mattered a lot more to the U.S. than it mattered to the Soviet Union. So for the Soviets had to make a decision on what they were willing to risk. The U.S. was willing to risk more, was willing to spend more. And we've got to take that into account, because if you don't take that into account, you miss the essential problem with Putin, which is, we can sit here and say, well, it would be crazy for him to use nuclear weapons. Well, that's from our perspective. We are not willing to fight a war over Ukraine, so of course it would be crazy to use nuclear weapons. He's made the decision that Ukraine is worth a war. And I think especially the issue of Crimea, where it is widely regarded by Russians as part of Russia, it's hard for me to see how he could survive politically to lose Crimea. And I think that's the kind of moment that you suddenly think, if you're Russian, your conventional forces are inferior to those of the West. But, that forces you to rely on nuclear weapons. But your hope is you can kind of scare the other side, show a willingness to use these. Try to find that step you take that's an escalation but kind of forces everyone to back away. It's a very dangerous maneuver, but I could see him doing it. Now, he's trying to use a nuclear threat to scare us. And my guess is there's a certain amount of bluff there. Would he use nukes for the Donbass? Tactical nukes, it's not clear how useful they would be. I mean, all those things are true. But still, we underestimate the interest of Russia, not only him, but also the ruling elite and the population. And if the perception is Russia is threatened by the West, I think we have to recognize that, yes, he could do that. And proposals that have been made in the U.S. that our response should be to destroy all the Russian conventional forces in Ukraine, sink anything in the Black Sea fleet, to my mind, these are genuinely insane. The notion that you could humiliate Russia, destroy its military capability, and it wouldn't respond, you talk about rolling the dice. It would just be extraordinary, because you're betting the future of the American homeland. You are risking triggering a nuclear war with that kind of behavior. So I think we have to take escalation very seriously. To my mind, that's why we need to remember what our interest is. I want Ukraine to maintain its independence and sovereignty. Support them to do that. But let's recognize that there are certain points you don't want to go past. and you want to make very clear to Ukraine, you're not going to help them get past that point. Because from our standpoint, it's a threat to our interests, frankly, vital interests, the security of our homeland and our people.
One thing about the way the war in Ukraine is currently being fought, we don't know when the Ukrainian counterattack is going to take place or how effective it will be. It's now a World War I trench warfare, and the Russians are very well dug in along a very, very wide defensive line. I think, including Crimea, they currently possess about 18% of Ukraine.
Yep.
My other observation is this. It's often the case, and it certainly was the case in World War II, that the Russian military behaves very poorly. After all, the Germans were near Moscow, near Leningrad. Yep. They almost did it. Russia has always relied on defense and depth. We helped resupply the Soviet armies. And at tremendous cost to them, they went after the Germans, sometimes human wave attacks against emplaced German machine gun, and took huge, huge losses. And of course, they'd have their commissars with their pistols behind the troops to shoot anyone who is retreating. I've supposedly an accurate account from a Russian soldier who was captured or who defected in this war said something similar is happening. Anyone who turns around or retreats or doesn't go forward will be shot. And as, again, it seems to be typical of Russian warfare, we keep thinking, well, what are they going to gain? They've destroyed the places they wish to occupy. But that's the way they fought World War II. Anyone who looks at Berlin in 1945, it was totally destroyed. Right. Anyone who looks at Grozny looked like Berlin.
Yeah.
And that's the way the eastern parts of Ukraine look. They don't really, that's their artillery war.
Yes.
They just completely destroyed the place. That's, again, to us, unacceptable and kind of crazy, but it's the way Russia has fought. It's certainly the way the Soviet Union fought its war and the way it's fought since the fall of the Soviet Union. Well, Doug, I think we're just about out of time, so I'm going to pose this question to you. Have we answered, should the U.S. or Europe make NATO great again?
I think we have. I mean, certainly,
the answer is
Europe. Now, the U.S. may have a role to play in helping push and urge and encourage the Europeans. It certainly makes sense to do things in a phased way where, you know, countries that have relied on the U.S. so long, you know, need some time to adapt their own policies. But we're living in a world in which the U.S. has to start setting priorities. And I think that the place to start is Europe, that the Europeans are capable. They are able to take over their own defense. It's long overdue. You know, we have to make it happen.
And we know, for instance, Finland, the newest member of NATO, has always taken its defense seriously. So in this case, they may actually be adding to the security of NATO rather than detracting from it.
Yeah, they always, their agreement with the Russians, at both sides, you know, maintained it. The Russians, the Soviets didn't try to take them over. But the Finns certainly tried to prepare that if they were attacked, they would give a very good account of themselves as they did during the Winter War.
Exactly. When they bloodied the Russians.
Oh, yeah. Very seriously. Yeah.
Doug, thank you very much. I would like to particularly thank Doug Bandow, who is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, for joining me to discuss this question about NATO, Europe, and the United States, in light, of course, of the current Russia-Ukraine war. I invite our audience to please go to the Westminster Institute website or to our YouTube channel to see our other offerings, quite a number on the Russia-Ukraine war, but also many on the question of the threat that the CCP presents in China, China and Japan, China and Taiwan, and other foreign policy questions, and even some domestic ones, like what are the origins of inflation from which we are currently suffering. So thank you for joining us today. I'm Robert Riley.